Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He discusses the recently announced initiative at HHS to make everyone's electronic medical records readily available to them on their smartphones at no cost to the patient. They're seeking true portability of one's own health information. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with the National Coordinator for Health IT at HHS, Dr. Donald Rucker, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Prior to joining ONC, Dr. Rucker was Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine and Biomedical Informatics at Ohio State University. He also served as Chief Medical Officer at Premise Health. He began his informatic career at DataMedic Corporation, where he developed the world's first Microsoft Windows-based electronic medical record. He earned his undergraduate degree at Harvard, his medical degree from UPenn, and his MBA and MS in medical computer science from Stanford. Dr. Rucker, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks.
You know, I think much of our audience knows that ONC's job is to build a private and secure nationwide health information system that supports meaningful use of health data. And you just recently, I think at the HIMSS conference, shared some exciting new bold initiatives that have come out of the Secretary's office, Secretary Azar, and also CMS Administrator Verma's office as well. Chief among them is a proposed rule to support seamless and secure exchange and use of electronic health information by giving patients and their healthcare providers secure access to health information. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners about the new rule and what you think is very significant about this exciting new direction.
Sure. What we're doing and proposing as a rule, it's out for public comment, is to actually allow patients to get their medical records on their smartphone. So if you think about it, in the last couple of years, you know, we've allowed patients to get access to their data through patient portals, right? But we haven't really allowed patients to control their data, taking it, moving it somewhere else. It really has not been possible in a practical way that sort of reflects our daily realities, using our smartphones for probably more stuff than we should. And so we're really putting the medical record into that consumer space where we live, right? Where we, you know, do whatever it is, Uber or Lyft or banking or airline reservations type of thing. Mm-hmm. All of that we have not been able to do. This rule requires providers to, in addition to providing the portal, to actually have a URL endpoint, the browser address that patients can download their medical records securely using standards-based application programming interfaces. That's a lot of technical jargon. Mm-hmm. It means you can take an app of your choice that ingests medical records, point it at your provider, and get your data on your smartphone in whatever way you want to use it. Pretty exciting.
That is pretty exciting. And, you know, Don, it reminds me of so many things in healthcare over the last decade or so where all of us in healthcare go, wow, that's amazing and revolutionary. And the patients go, duh, what took you so long to figure out that this is that this is what we needed? But we know, of course, there are concerns and complications. And I understand that the rules still leave some unanswered questions as to the how, of course, how we make all this health data seamlessly accessible to all patients and at no cost to them. And I say that that's remarkable because that's such a far cry from what we see today, where patients seeking access to their information often find out they have to come in person and sign a release. And of course, there's a longstanding tradition of allowing providers to charge for the release of that information. So can we start with, tell me what Congress defined as information blocking? What's the vision around that?
So one of the things that you pointed out, with modern application programming interfaces, we have a whole set of technical opportunities to do this much more readily than we have in the past, right? So it sort of needs both, you know, a will and a way. In terms of the will, Congress has heard a lot of complaints just exactly along the lines you outlined, Margaret. You know, providers don't want to provide the data. So in the law now, the law being the 21st Century Cures Act, signed into law by President Obama, I assure you, President Trump, the White House, are absolutely on top of, enforcing this access for patients.
Great.
It is prohibited for providers to do what's called information blocking, you know, to not provide you with your medical data electronically. You know, and in the past, of course, you know, access has been more problematic. But we were asked at the Office of the National Coordinator, again, part of Health and Human Services, to define allowable exceptions. The baseline assumption is providers will provide the data to patients electronically through these endpoints. So you can download it on your smartphone. Once it's on your smartphone, you can do with it as you desire. But the exceptions, so we've crafted out for proposed rulemaking some things around privacy, security, potential patient harm. This would probably be, you know, with underlying mental illness type of issues. Then also some technical allowances on what the EMR vendors can charge the providers who have to provide these application programming interfaces, as well as some common sense provisions for some deep fundamental technical reasons. The computer request can't be acted on, you know, that's an exception, or, you know, if the server is being rebooted. But the base assumption is that providers, so doctors and hospitals, through their EMRs are going to provide an endpoint that an app of your choosing will be able to download your medical record.
Well, that is just exciting news, I think, for everybody,
all
consumers listening. Margaret was talking about smartphones, and you were as well. I think we live in this world of worries about hacking and cybersecurity and the like, and that platform might be one that's vulnerable. To what extent are you working with the companies or engaged in that whole issue of making sure we're going to put it into an environment that's safe and secure and works for the patient?
Yeah, so I would throw out to your listeners that just in general, whenever you hear something about cybersecurity, you sort of really dig into what exactly is the issue. You know, is this just somebody hijacking a password, sort of the quote-unquote phishing attacks? Is this a deep vulnerability innately in the software because of a bug? Or is this something that where we've actually consented to, in some fashion, to allow the data to be reused, right? So the Facebook type of or Google type of questions. So when you look at, for the patient record on the smartphone, I think there are two areas. The technical stuff is quite secure. So that is under something called OAuth2. That's a, you know, a nerd alert term for the, you know, encryption security protocol. It's the same thing that's used by banks, you know, with your financial data or any other, you know, extremely important data. So we're using state-of-the-art security there, and patients have to give consent. It's actually very similar to the type of security that's used today if you log on to a patient portal from your provider, but it's actually more empowering to the patients because they actually can revoke consent, that, you know, they can control it. So it's actually a much more empowering thing for the patient. Then patients, I think, will have to, you know, make an assessment of what apps they use to hold their medical data. Just the same way you decide, you know, do I want to use a banking app? You know, what bank? You know, what brokerage firm? So you have to sort of figure out, is this an operation that I trust? And people will make that determination. It'll be under their control which apps they store their data on or use to access their data. But they will have to, as with every other choice they make on their smartphone, think about what are the privacy implications here, right? Mm-hmm. The reality is, of course, we give up lots of privacy. You know, anybody who uses Facebook, yeah. anybody who uses Google, anybody who carries a smartphone around with them, anybody who uses a credit card, right? We've already made many choices where we've said, you know what, we understand they have our data, mm-hmm. we're comfortable with the protections and their behavior, and, you know, we want that convenience. I think different patients will draw that line in different places depending on the nature of the medical data, their you know, clinical issues, the opportunities for the smartphone to give them better ways of treatment, new ways of treatment. I think the biggest issue in all of this that is often underlying interoperability is so much healthcare is unaffordable in America. So many people have massive issues affording healthcare. And so one of the big benefits here is to inject competition into healthcare delivery systems that have often configured themselves to prevent patients from taking their data and shopping.
Interesting.
So I think all of that will come into, you know, the patient side mm-hmm. of what they do with their data.
Great.
But the technical side is secure.
I hadn't thought about that patient sort of comparison and shopping relative to cost dimension of it. But I wonder if I can go back to the information blocking piece for a moment.
Sure.
And we talked about one instance, perhaps where there's underlying mental illness concerns that you identified. My understanding is that the team at ONC has actually proposed 7 exceptions where the patient or another provider might request health information and the request can be denied. I wonder if you would tell us what the other exceptions are, who they're designed to protect, and I'd also love it if you could comment on, did you within ONC convene any kind of focus groups of consumers or get any feedback on what those exceptions ought to be?
Yeah, so the exceptions, again, I think the exceptions, I would look at them as fairly narrow and fairly specific. The baseline assumption is the providers are going to release the data to patients. The exceptions are designed to be narrow in that the patients are in control. I think for too long, the American medical establishment has been extremely paternalistic. You know, we've all grown up with other people deciding the health care we get since the start of Medicare and maybe even the World War II provisions sure. around having health insurance be pre-tax. Mm-hmm. And so we've had this very, very paternalistic view. Patients can't decide. They're not smart enough to have right. their data. I don't buy into that at all, frankly. I think it's just not true, and it's not right. So the exceptions are designed to be narrow. The specific exceptions are, if there's something where we think there would be harm coming to a patient or another person, you know, this would be very, very narrow, I would think. The second exception is something where we think that the release of the information would violate privacy. Again, there need to be some very specific knowledge here. And it cannot be, with all these exceptions, it can't just be like a blanket excuse. Oh, we never release it because we think it might be privacy.
Yeah.
There have to be very specific. The other exceptions are security, very similar to privacy, again, very specific. In terms of costs, obviously interfaces, software, access, all of this costs money, but we've heard a lot of complaints. We've actually met with many, many folks in putting these rules together, in particular with a lot of entrepreneurial firms, you know, that would like to provide new services to the American public, you know, and often at much lower cost.
Uh-huh.
And we hear that the, you know, vendor community often is charging $1 million for them to have access to the data, you know, the charges that bear no relationship. Uh-huh. You can obviously price an API out of existence, right? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, you can say, well, there's access, but it costs you, you know, some vast amount of money. So as part of opening this up, preventing information blocking, you're only allowed to charge reasonably incurred costs. Now, this includes a return on capital, but, you know, this is not where you, you know, can charge costs that don't really bear any relationship to the vendor cost or the provider cost. And there's also a second provision of the seven here on if you're claiming intellectual property, that you have to license it on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. We've heard complaints that these APIs are only opened up if the vendor feels that this would might want to compete in this line of business, and then they won't let this competitor have access to the data. So we've heard these complaints, again, multiple times, and so that's why the non-discriminatory provision is in there. And then the final two of the seven are really just things that are simply infeasible, right? Because think about feasibility. An app is going to an endpoint and asking for something. Well, you know, demands could be infinite, right? So, you know, it has to be something that can actually be provided in a reasonable type of way. And then finally, if there's, you know, downtime, these are servers, you know, as we all know, IT is, computers need to be rebooted, those types of things. So those are the seven exceptions to information blocking. We think in net, it's going to free up the information for patients.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which is tasked with building a private and secure nationwide health information system that supports the interoperable flow of health data. You know, Don, it's kind of an exciting new era that we're going into. And I think one of the things that we've heard from our patients is that they're smart, but the information tends to be boring and not in context. And I'm wondering what's going to happen in terms of the entrepreneurial aspect of Facebook. And I guess my four kids remind me they don't use Facebook anymore, but Instagram. But are we going to see, because people like to share information. Really, a lot of people are sharing information regularly. I take it what might be occurring is that there's an endpoint. They have an app that they've developed. It may be one where they're sharing it with a whole community of people mm-hmm. who share common diseases, or it may be a community of their family and friends, that we're going to see the entrepreneurs thinking about ways that, for people who choose, if you want to slice and dice this, or you can parse something off and send it off to one of your relatives, you're going to be free to do that. Is this a whole new era? When you talk about sitting with those entrepreneurial organizations, are you hearing people starting to discuss this development as well?
Yeah, you know, Mark, I think that's sort of, those are going to be some of the things, and we've already seen some of these from obviously a number of small companies, and Apple obviously is a large company that have, you know, done that first step. And as you point out, you know, it can be pretty dry, but mm-hmm. I think the real win is going to be in, you know, what I think in the software world is called a mashup. Mm-hmm. And so it's when you, right now, if you look at the app, and I don't know, I've heard numbers of 200,000 health apps. I have no idea. I haven't done
a
personal count, but there are a number of them. But if you look at that app universe, right, if you go to the app stores, you find there's a very small handful that have access to medical data, and then there's a whole other set of apps about health that have no access to medical data. Mm-hmm. You know, fitness apps, diet apps, things that just, you know, basically track motion. I think the win and the entrepreneurial is going to be when people figure out new ways to blend streams of information to come up with entirely new products. And let me go back to the ride-sharing services. So if you dissect out Uber or Lyft, think about all the different things that they've mashed into that service, right? So they've put in APIs, application programming interfaces, to mapping, to credit card, to traffic, to your, you know, consumer database, to their driver database, probably 10 other things under the covers, right? So the win is they've taken a bunch of things that before were not connectable, right? In the old days, if you wanted a cab, if you could even find one, if it even serviced your neighborhood, you know, you'd call a dispatcher, you'd hear that, you know, chatter in the background about whether somebody felt like coming by. You never know when they were coming, whether they came. So, I mean, just think back. We're in that old school era where, you know, your stuff is sort of just locked in the chart, I think it's going to be tremendously exciting.
Yes.
It's going to play out over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And the winners here will be combinations that, you know, the three of us on this phone call
right.
won't have ever even dreamed
right.
of.
That's true.
Well, that's a very exciting future. And, you know, we'll do one nod to the past, Mark, I think, and say that we have enjoyed working with, learning from, talking to your predecessors at HHS and ONC and so many people within those offices that have worked so long and hard to get us to this point.
A font of creativity.
Really amazing yeah. people where we can actually say to patients, yes, you'll be able to get all that, all of your health information downloaded to your smartphone. So I just want to take a moment mm-hmm. and really celebrate all those people and the progress that people have made. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
My predecessors have laid the foundation for this. And it's taken a number of years.
It absolutely has. And, you know, one of our favorite lines that came out of the almost two decades of this was Todd Parks and his liberate the data philosophy. And it was liberate the data for a lot of different purposes. But one of them absolutely was for the possibility of research to have, you know, data sets that we never dreamed possible and the technology to actually use data sets larger than we ever dreamed possible to think about ways to improve health, prevent disease, promote well-being, and perhaps even save costs as well. How does this most recent direction and this rule increase access to data for research purposes? And are you excited about that dimension as well? Or do you think we were already there under the previous rules?
Oh, no, I don't think, I think this is one of the things that the new technology has opened up and some other work we're doing at ONC with the National Institute of Health on Sync for Science and Sync for Genes, where we're using these modern APIs to hook up patient records for research, allow patients to participate in these research trials. It's very exciting, right? Of course, the patients who are most interested are the patients with, you know, major illness, for whom this opens up some real possibilities for new treatments that would actually change their life in just, you know, stunning ways. The beauty of the technology here of these FHIR, Fast Healthcare Interoperable Resource type of application programming interfaces is that we can broaden the entire research pool of data. Historically, research has been these heavily controlled clinical trials where they've used a lot of statistics and a lot of statistical work with a small number of patients mm-hmm. to extrapolate to the rest of us. As we know, that's expensive, it's time-consuming, it often doesn't include, you know, minorities mm-hmm. or people who are older
right.
or younger or, you know, of a different sex, of a different race, of a different genetic makeup. And, you know, then if you don't have those pools of clinical information, you know, what you're doing is just the worse for it. So we think this is going to allow us to rethink the enterprise. Interestingly enough, this open application programming interface part is part of the 21st Century Cures Act that also rethinks how the FDA handles data.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of a, it's really in harmony.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. You can learn more about this new proposed rules and are invited to submit comments mm-hmm. on the rule by going to healthit.gov, or you can follow them on Twitter at @ONC_HealthIT. Don, thank you. And as Margaret said, thank your team for the contributions that you're making to advancing health data interoperability and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Mark, Margaret, thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In a February town hall event on CNN, newly announced presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders repeated a few claims about healthcare that we've debunked before. Sanders said that President Trump sought to, quote, throw 32 million people off of the health care they had. But that figure includes some who would choose to no longer purchase insurance if the individual mandate penalty were removed, which occurred this year. The figure Sanders cites is a government estimate of what would happen if Congress repealed the Affordable Care Act without replacing it. President Trump supported the Republican-backed American Health Care Act, a bill that sought partial repeal and replacement of the ACA. But when that plan faltered, he also advocated for an immediate repeal of the ACA with a replacement at a later date. A 2017 analysis by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which fits that replace later strategy, did find that approach would increase the number of uninsured by 32 million people over 10 years. But not all of them would be thrown off their insurance, as Sanders said. The CBO said that some people in the individual market would decide not to have insurance, partly because they were getting coverage under current law to avoid paying the individual mandate penalty. Sanders also claimed the U.S. is spending, quote, almost twice as much per capita on health care as any other country. Estimates do show the U.S. spends almost double what many other countries do, but not all of them. Sanders has made a similar claim since at least 2015. The U.S. spent $10,209 per capita in 2017, according to the most recent data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's more than double the 2017 OECD average of $4,069 per capita, and quite a lot more than most other developed nations. However, Switzerland spent $8,009 per capita, Luxembourg spent $6,475 per capita, and Norway spent $6,351 per capita. So the U.S. didn't spend almost double what they did. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Stanford-based bioengineer Manu Prakash has a simple goal. He wants to create a portable medical lab small enough to fit in a backpack, and he's already developed a tool that fits the bill. While sitting under a tree in Uganda, he noticed that the local medical clinic's door was propped open by an expensive centrifuge machine, one that was reliant on electricity, now broken and no longer in use. And he wondered, how could he create a portable centrifuge that would be inexpensive to make, easy to operate, and easy to replace? His inspiration came from a simple childhood toy, the Whirligig, a toy that functions by pulling two ends of a string threaded through a round object like a button.
So we spent a significant portion of this time truly understanding the mathematical phase space for how you can convert linear motion into rotational motion. And there's some beautiful mathematics hidden inside this object.
So he took this simple toy idea to another level, creating a human-powered centrifuge made from simple components: paper, twine, and plastic. Altogether, each paperfuge, as he calls it, can be constructed in under 2 minutes and costs only 20 cents. And yet, remarkably, it works extremely efficiently.
With this set of principles, we're able to essentially make a centrifuge that spins all the way to 120,000 RPM. In the lab, we can separate and pull out malaria parasites from blood, separate blood plasma.
It's currently being tested for malaria diagnoses, but is being readied for far more complex diagnostic challenges.
This is a tool that requires no electricity, no infrastructure. You can carry them around in your pockets for a price point of 20 cents.
The paperfuge, a cheap but highly effective field tool for clinicians, providing a portable solution to diagnostic challenges, creating a quicker pathway to diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com. or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.